of some pretty cockamamie stories in my time, but the idea that two dudes in a cave could build a sophisticated flying suit of armor when they weren't even provided with coffee? Give me a break. They never would have made it through the planning phase. Luckily for us, we don't need sophisticated technology to make sure we're never without excellent coffee. We just need an internet connection and sparkplugcoffee.com. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf and half calf. But the best part is that they deliver this exceptional coffee to your home or office or cave within a week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you don't need to trouble your overworked and suspiciously dedicated assistant to remember to order more. Your next batch of fresh coffee is already on the way! And right now, Sparkplug has a special offer for Top 100 listeners. If you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 10% off your next coffee order. The offer doesn't apply to any of the great gear Sparkplug carries, but it does apply to any size order, and you don't need to be a new customer to take advantage. The time's never been better to start making the best coffee you've ever had in your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hey, you Playboy superheroes, and thank you for devouring the next 112 project. Our AFI Great Movies analysis is so far in our rearview mirror now that others started tackling the same thing years after we finished. Posers. Not really. So now we review movies of all stripes, and we spoil them. I'm the snarky arms dealer who spends a lot of time tinkering in basements and caves, Ryan Ellis, and this is the turncoat who tried to kill me, and worse, stole my tech, my wife Bev.
That's me.
She is Obadiah, Zachariah, Malachi, Jebediah, Odebiah, Stain. Simpsons reference. Okay, the coming attraction trivia for this week's picture, Iron Man, etc. There are at least three comic book movies that end with the main character saying his superhero's his alias name, basically, as the last line of the movie. Name those three, or more, if there are more movies than just those three.
Iron Man. And the only other one I could find, and I gotta tell you, I spent like an afternoon on YouTube looking up superhero movie endings. Spider-Man, 2002, Tobey Maguire.
Right.
Ends with him in voiceover.
Spider-Man.
Yeah. What is the other one?
Darkman.
Oh, get out of here! I knew it was going to be one of those obscure, old, pre-Marvel...
1990s, not that far back.
Oh, come on.
Call me Darkman, and even in a way, although the character doesn't say it, Commissioner Gordon says at the end of The Dark Knight, he's silent protector, all these things. A Dark Knight. But that's not the character saying it. It's not the person saying it. It's somebody else saying it.
I know of what you speak because I watched that ending along with the ending of, like, every Marvel film, and none of them ended like that.
I said comic book, and Darkman does qualify.
I drove myself crazy.
All right, Iron Man was released by Paramount and, of course, Marvel. Marvel got their start here, really. MCU did. On May 2nd, 2008, so just over 10 years ago. It was a gigantic hit. I don't know why people wouldn't know what this movie's about, Bev, but give them a skinny about the movie anyway. For Iron Man.
Robert Downey Jr. is Tony Stark, a charming, brilliant, and astoundingly rich industrialist who runs his father's weapons development firm. When he's kidnapped by enemies of the state, he puts his wits to the task to develop a sophisticated suit that uses technology to effectively turn him into a superhero. A superhero with a new and not-so-popular agenda for his company.
Or, in a nutshell, affluent defense contractor wields flying sarcophagus to destroy his own product.
He says he's not going to make weapons anymore, and then he immediately makes a weapon. The suit's a weapon.
His own weapon.
Yes.
But I do love
the
that
difference
when
he'll make weapons for himself and only himself to use.
I love when he flies over halfway across the world, in fact, and destroys Stark weapons in, I guess, Afghanistan, right where he was
They never
kidnapped.
Really say where he is, but I think it's presumed to be Afghanistan.
So a bunch of numbers before we get into the body of the podcast. The Rotten Tomatoes numbers, 94% of critics liked the film, 251 fresh, 17 rotten, and 91% of audiences. So great scores there. Iron Man 2, incidentally, has 73 and 72 on Rotten Tomatoes. So not bad considering that movie's not all that well liked by a ton of people. And Iron Man 3, which is very well liked, is at 80 and 78, which is better than Iron Man 2, but not as good as Iron Man 1. And I think they're right about that in all cases. I think Iron Man 1 is the best one. Also, The Avengers, Captain America Civil War, and Spider-Man Homecoming, which co-star Robert Downey Jr. as Iron Man, are in the 90s for Rotten Tomatoes critics, so they're well-respected as well. As far as box office goes, it was second in 2008 behind The Dark Knight, and it's 140th when adjusted for inflation on the Box Office Mojo list. Iron Man 3, by the way, is 113th. That was a monster hit, which I know came out when we were going on our honeymoon, and I had to hear about it but not have spoilers ruin it for me. I saw the movie when we came back from our honeymoon 5 years ago.
There's got to be some Marvel movies that are right up there, at least the top 20, right?
The first Avengers is, yeah. I think so. I'm not sure. Oh,
Black Panther?
Black Panther and Avengers Infinity War. I didn't look all these numbers up, but they're up there for sure. They're in the adjusted for inflation list, probably in the top 25 or 50 anyway. So this movie is fun. It tackles some ultra-serious concepts, though, especially in the first half. You've got a merchant of death with a miniaturized arc reactor. Very unusual superhero movie. But this is also the flying Batman, I think, in a way.
He has so many similarities to Batman.
And what did you think of Iron Man?
Oh, I still love this movie. And this is not the kind of movie I typically enjoy that much. It's just so charming and fun. Because this movie, I had a crush on Robert Downey Jr. for like a good 3 years.
Because of this movie, not from what he had done before.
Almost entirely this. I definitely had the hots for him when he was in Ally McBeal. Full Robert Downey Jr. charm. But I think Iron Man and Deadpool are the two characters that are perhaps the most perfectly cast superheroes in cinema history.
Well said. Tom Cruise, Hugh Jackman, Nicolas Cage, and Clive Owen were all in line to maybe have the role. Tom Cruise was the one, I think, that was maybe the closest. Hugh Jackman might have been great, but he was already Wolverine, so why be this character, too? I don't think that would have worked as well. Nicolas Cage didn't really have the coolness factor. But I'm one of the people that did not have faith in RDJ, as I'll call him now, to play this character because of his history, but more so because I just didn't see him playing Iron Man. I didn't know much about the character from the comics. I'm not a comic person. I don't know much about that to begin with. But I was wrong about Heath Ledger the same year, a few months after this movie, in The Dark Knight. Way wrong. And I was certainly wrong about Downey as well, because he might be the best character in the entire Marvel-verse MCU.
I don't think I've ever been more invested in comic books than I was shortly before this film came out. I had a boyfriend at the time who was super into it, and he let me all kinds of comic books to read, and that included the Marvel reboot of The Avengers. And I was reading that, I was really enjoying them, and I really knew the character of Iron Man well. And around the same time, I really was also into the movie Kiss Kiss Bang Bang,
right,
which is the reason that RDJ got cast as Iron Man, because he's so cool and funny. Jon Favreau saw him in that. He thought that he'd be perfect as Iron Man. When I heard that he was cast, I was absolutely thrilled. I had 1,000% faith that he was going to do a great job. It was great casting.
Shane Black directed Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, and he directed Iron Man 3. Jon Favreau wanted him in this role because of his baggage, not against the baggage.
Tony Stark is an alcoholic. In the comics more so. I think in the sequels they kind of
address it a little more. Because
he has PTSD. Yeah, yeah. He's also one of those cinematic alcoholics that always has a drink in his hand.
Well, in honor of that.
And he makes it look cool. Oh, yeah, cheers.
It's also a very hot day in very late June.
Yes, that's why I need alcohol, because it's hot.
Slurp.
I have no excuse in January when I also have a drink while we're recording. Jon Favreau thought that that baggage, the fact that he had it all and lost it, he went to prison. As a matter of fact, they consulted him when they were doing the cave scenes where he's supposed to be improvising with what he has to make the suit. They were like, hey, you were in prison. Talk to us about some of the improvisations you made. And one of them that I think made the cut, they would use a sock to brew tea or coffee, maybe it was, because they didn't have coffee filters. I think that may have made the cut, but used that as a source. Because he spent, what, a year and a half in prison.
I wonder if he wanted an American cheeseburger when he came out of his prison in reality, as the character does.
Who knows? He improvised a lot. They did a lot of improvising on set. Favreau said that he wanted to shoot it like a Robert Altman film, which it doesn't come across like in a Robert Altman film, but it definitely has a unique sense of humor, and it doesn't feel like it has that over-polish that a lot of superhero films
have. I think the non-action scenes lean that way. Favreau also wanted it to be rom-com-esque 40s style. His Girl Friday, for example, primarily between Downey and Paltrow. She didn't like the improvising, and she really couldn't keep up with him, but maybe more so than keeping up with him or not being able to is that she didn't know what he's going to say next. I like Gwyneth Paltrow. I think she's been good in a lot of movies. But it maybe exposes her a little bit if she can't keep up with an improviser, because that's the job.
Well, if this her strength, right?
Is to read lines.
Is to read lines. Different actors have different
strengths. Even Jeff Bridges didn't love that the script wasn't finished when he got the role, or that it was so loose. But then he rolled with it and apparently had a lot of fun. And I love Jeff Bridges. I know you do too. Most people in the world who love movies do like the guy. And it's not like he's bad in this movie, but A, you know he's the villain the first instant you see him.
Oh, yeah.
And B, it's not his best work by any means. He's fine, but he's playing a Marvel villain. And until we finally got Thanos earlier this year in Avengers Infinity War, their villains were almost always, and maybe Loki as well. Like I said,
yeah,
Loki
counts.
Yeah. Otherwise, their villains have usually been forgettable, if not bad. And this is one of the ones that's not great.
Robert Downey Jr. notwithstanding, I think that most Marvel characters do decaffeinate the actors who play them. Most actors in their Marvel characters are not doing the best work. Nobody's going to say that The Avengers is Mark Ruffalo's best work, or even that Captain America is Chris Evans' best work.
For him, it's on the line.
Okay, yeah, maybe that's a bad example.
He's been quite good in those movies, and it's really evolved for him. He's become better as they go along.
Hemsworth also has gotten better as he's gone along. Thor Ragnarok. Mm-hmm. Finally, they kind of let him be himself. Mm-hmm. But I think for the most part, it sucks the personality out of actors a little bit because they're taking over these iconic characters. Characters that weren't iconic before Marvel decided to make them iconic in these movies. Because Iron Man was not a popular Marvel character. Not by a long shot. They sold all of their characters to other studios because they weren't in the business of making movies. So they sold the rights to Spider-Man. They sold the rights to X-Men. Those are their real bread and butter
characters.
Fantastic Four as well. That's right. I wonder if when they rebooted the Avengers comics was a way to increase interest in them because they were the only characters they could make a movie with if they wanted to make a film studio.
They had no idea. There's no way Kevin Feige, who runs Marvel, I think had been a few years before this. He may have been a producer on the 2003 Hulk. He definitely wasn't the 2008 Hulk, which was about a month after this came out. But anyway, whenever he took over, he had a vision. But there's no way this guy could be honest in saying, I could see us going to Infinity War and making money pretty much every single time out with what is now, I think, 19 movies they've made. And for the record, I've liked pretty much all of them. I haven't really hated any of them. But the other part of it I'll say is that I haven't really loved any of them. This might be the best one of them all, and it's one of the reasons we did pick it. Even though Avengers is fun, Thor Ragnarok is a lot of fun, but it also was only a couple months old. Black Panther was great. We could rattle off a lot of movies.
More than a few of them.
And I didn't dislike the Thor movies, which are so fantastical. One thing about this movie that really stands out is that, within reason, this could happen. Kind of like Batman. This is not impossible that someone could do something like this. Superman, Thor, pretty much impossible.
Arguably the two most popular superheroes in America, let's say right now, are Batman and Iron Man. Mm-hmm. Iron Man, who nobody heard of, barely, before this movie. Mm-hmm. But all you have to do is own a home on Halloween night, and you'll discover just how popular Iron Man is. Every second little boy that comes to your door is dressed as Iron Man. And I wonder if that's part of the appeal. I mean, the charm, the charisma is a huge part of it. But I think that there's something about not having an actual superpower above and beyond being smart and resourceful. He's like MacGyver with $1 billion.
Even more so, he's an absolute genius. MacGyver might not be quite a genius.
Okay, fine. Elon Musk.
Yeah, okay.
Thing going on. But charm. He's much more charming than Elon Musk.
And probably even more money. We mentioned the terrorist angle in this film. It's unusual that a comic book flick opens with a terror attack after the Jericho demo we see early on. And by the way, can't the terrorist figure out that he's not building them a Jericho device? There's cameras everywhere in that cave. And they really should have realized after a while, that's not the bomb.
Yeah, he's not making a missile. He's making a helmet. They know the difference between a missile and a helmet.
And a suit, for that matter.
Yes.
But I do ask this question also. How could the metal battery implant thing that Yinsen creates not cause an infection? Because it is jury-rigged, and it is saving Tony Stark's life. Okay, but how does it not cause an infection and kill him that way?
They explain it several times. They say it's just a magnet that's keeping the shrapnel from reaching his heart.
Yeah.
Well, if all you need is a magnet, then why does it go all the way into his chest? And why is it when Pepper is changing it for him? If it's just a magnet, you take it out. It's not like all that shrapnel is instantly going to pierce your heart. It's going to stay put. And shouldn't a surgeon be able to remove the shrapnel eventually? Mm. I feel like they didn't really explain that properly.
That may be a comic book problem. Maybe the comic book didn't explain it well enough and we had to go with what they had from that before. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to veer too much of these characters. It's like Hulk being the way he is. It's maybe a little bit illogical. Well, it's very illogical. but I mean, within the realm of believability, it's even illogical. But they went with what the comic book said.
And like all superhero movies, you just suspend your disbelief and enjoy. You don't really overthink it. But this was like a big post-9/11 superhero movie. because it had the vaguely Middle Eastern villains.
Not vaguely, they are Middle Eastern.
Oh, yeah. I mean vaguely because they never really say what country they're from. Right. Are they Taliban? Like, they never want to say
the Ten Rings. Taliban. The Ten Rings.
Oh, that's
which was originally going to lead to the Mandarin being the movie's villain. The Mandarin is Iron Man's greatest villain in the comics, and it was the villain in the third movie, but then there was that big fake-out, or not really so much a fake-out, but that big disappointment that greatly cast Ben Kingsley wasn't really the Mandarin. I thought that was fun. I don't have any stake in this the way a lot of comic book fans would. Apparently they were so pissed when that came out that it was just an actor playing the character. Although apparently the end credits of Iron Man 3 are that there really is a guy out there who looks exact same as Trevor, whatever his name is, I forget his name, but the Ben Kingsley guy who's playing an actor who really is the Mandarin. So it's an actor playing the Mandarin to cover for Guy Pearce in Iron Man 3, but there's a real Mandarin who looks like Ben Kingsley.
If you're trying to make those hardcore comic book fans happy, you're just going to chase your tail. It's kind of impossible, especially when you consider that Iron Man as a character has been around since the 60s. How many iterations has there been of Iron Man or the Mandarin or all the stories he's gone through? And then there was the reboot where they started from the beginning in a much more like adult context. What did they call it? The Ultimates Marvel Universe.
Okay.
Where they rewrote all the comics in a much more grown-up context. They rewrote things. They changed things. Just gotta be a little more flexible with these characters, but people are never gonna be.
Don't tell the Superman to be flexible.
Especially not in that suit. So prior to Iron Man, I feel like superhero movies felt so much more domestic. Batman focused on Gotham City. Spider-Man went after minor criminals in New York. Superman would save people from house fires. He would get kittens out of trees and stuff, and he would save Lois Lane, but he pretty much stuck to...
Lex Luthor also.
It was an American villain.
You mean the remake they did in 2006?
Just in general, the character of Superman. He doesn't really bother with foreign affairs. He's there to help America. But Iron Man doesn't do anything to make America better. Literally nothing. He instead focuses on the group that kidnapped him in the Middle East. The Ten... What do you call them? Ten Circles?
Ten Rings.
Ten Rings.
Revenge!
Yes. Yeah, it's revenge. I mean, they're bad people. Of course, we're okay with them getting slaughtered, and we'll talk later about how he has no authority to do anything.
Yeah.
He is just straight up a mass murderer.
Just like Batman can be sometimes, although Batman's not supposed to murder people, but as we know in the recent movies, he does.
And it's strange that Tony in the beginning, he's selling kind of like an old-fashioned weapon in a way.
A bunker buster.
Because it would spread Jericho. It. Yeah.
Mm.
But it's like a weapon of mass destruction, wouldn't you say? When they show the demonstration...
Welcome to war, though.
For all intents and purposes, it's a weapon of mass destruction, but the modern military fighting in the post-9/11 wars... used much more surgical strikes that they couldn't use weapons like
that.
They
used drones and they killed the wrong people that way instead of using these bunker
busters. Sure, but how many people would they have killed if they dropped a nuke or a bunker buster, as you say? If they dropped a weapon like that, there'd be way more casualties too. America hasn't deployed a weapon of mass destruction like that since the 40s. So it's kind of like a strange thing. It's the weapon you need to drop once. Many people argued that the nuclear bomb saved more lives than it took because it ended the war.
Yeah, I have issues with that, but okay.
Well, let's just say lots of people have issues with that. I think because in my old age I'm becoming more and more of a communist or something, I notice now going back and watching it. I watched it so many times when it
Lock
came out.
Lock her up. Lock her up. Lock her.
No, man. Now they would elect me to Congress. But I noticed so much what a conservative film this is. It's very pro-weapons industry. The only reason he wants to stop making weapons is because the enemies are getting their hands on them, not because he has any compunction about people in that country getting killed
wrong.
By his weapons.
I think you're wrong about that. I think Yinsen is the heart of this movie more so than Tony with his metaphorical heart that's iron. Or Pepper, who's also a big heart in the film, and all the films that she's been in with him. But Yinsen, who sacrificed himself, Sean Tube, I think, or Taub, however you pronounce his name. He was in Crash, by the way.
That's where I knew him from.
He's the one who fires the blanks in Crash. He's also been in Homeland, the TV series that we gave up on. I love his last lines, "Don't waste your life." But I think that not only did Tony start to feel this way about doing the right thing, but Yinsen is probably the Jiminy Cricket in the back of his head. He doesn't need to be shown a flashback. We don't need to be shown a flashback of him saying, "Wait a second, Yinsen told me to do the right thing." When he flies over, and by the way, he does that very fast. He flies over to, let's say, Afghanistan. I don't know how fast his suit will take him over there, but he's there pretty quickly. But he lands and he has taken out all the bad guys who are holding people hostages using human shields, which the American military couldn't do anything about. And he blows up his own weapons depot that they've taken. I do think he's got a conscience, and I do think he's got a heart by this point in the film. You say it's a right-wing or at least conservative movie, and I'll let you have the floor back in a second. But I think that he does actually have a bleeding heart, so to speak, for a guy who's not lost his heart, but his heart's affected by metal. along with the fact that he wants to be the ultimate power to take out the bad guys. Kind of like Batman. He's a vigilante, but I think in both cases, maybe even more so, Tony Stark, they're doing it for the right reasons.
I think in both the cases of Batman and Iron Man, and both movies I think are very conservative, the overarching theme or message in these films is that it's okay for one person to have all the power, just so long as it's the right person. That it's not democracy that's better. What would you call it? A superheroocracy is okay. Yeah. It just has to be Tony with the suit and not Obadiah.
The movies do play that out. Captain America Civil War is all about that. And guess who's on the side of registering superheroes? Which was also a plot line in the X-Men movies. Tony Stark. He's for it. Captain America is not. And that's what Civil War is all about. And it also plays out into Infinity War. Tony and Steve do not have a face-to-face scene in Civil War. I assume in the next movie that they have, that'll play off this whole thing with what Thanos has done. We won't give it away in case people still haven't seen Infinity War. But they have to have their resolution because it's very much unresolved at the end of Civil War. But you're saying he's a guy who's saying, well, in my hands it's fine, like Batman does. But as the movies play out, he's not that way.
I'm not saying that Tony believes that. I'm saying Marvel believes that.
No, that may be
true.
That
is the message that comes across over and over again. The citizens are safest when there is just one superhero, one super smart billionaire. And let's not forget that he inherited his wealth. He inherited his company. Of course he would have been successful no matter how he was born. Anybody who's that smart and industrious, I'm sure he would have done fine, but he never would have gotten where he was without being born filthy rich. And how did he get filthy rich? He is a weapons dealer.
Yeah. Well, that's the nutshell.
Yeah, I saw an interview with Spike Lee. What's his name? Stan Lee. I saw an interview with Stan Lee once where he said that part of the reason he created Iron Man was just to mess with people or to challenge himself, where he thought it was the 60s and there was just no greater villain than a weapons dealer. So he's like, oh, I'm going to make a character who is a weapons dealer who everybody is going to love and will be the biggest hero. Not that Iron Man at the time was ever their most popular character, but it was obviously popular enough to last for decades until this point when now he is one of the most popular
in the movies characters. He is the most popular character, I think, that they have. The MCU characters often have military connections. Iron Man does, the Hulk does, Captain America does. Even Black Widow, I suppose, to some extent. Whether other characters or people, whatever, that the military wants to use to their benefit, or they were created by the military, like Captain America. And the Hulk is being tracked down by the military in the movie in 2003 and 2008. And I suppose you could argue in these movies, but not so much. They kind of forget about that because he's fighting off aliens from another world.
And you could wonder if part of the reason why so many people in America right now believe there is, what do they call it, the shadow government? Because in all these movies, there is a shadow government. There is S.H.I.E.L.D. Maybe not a shadow government, but definitely this incredibly powerful and very well-resourced group of people who are running things behind the scenes. And another thing that's super conservative is there's tons of military porn. All the soldiers, it is a tragedy that, of course, it's a tragedy anyway, the soldiers die in the beginning of the film, but they're romanticized. And there's such serious wealth porn, the house, the cars, the women. Everything about it is pro-capitalism.
No, very much so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Tony's also an absentee landlord of his own company, so it's not that surprising that Obadiah Stane has an easy opening to take over.
Until the last act, you could easily sympathize with Obadiah.
Yeah, until he goes full-on villain, yeah. Wearing the original suit. I like that touch that he actually steals the guy's tech and wears the same suit. It's not a version of it. It's that suit with maybe some enhancements, but it's what Tony created over there months and months ago. Obadiah Stane is a fair assessment of weapons manufacturers, I think, too. The double dealing. When it's revealed that he is a bad guy and he goes over Farhan Tahir, I guess is the actor's name. He looks a little like Molarayam in the Indiana Jones and Temple of Doom movie. But he's the main villain that captured Tony Stark. And when Bridges goes over there and he's finally revealed as the bad guy, dun-dun-dun, what a non-shock that was. But the double dealing that Obadiah is doing with the government and with these villains, these bad guys who want awful things to happen to the whole world, they're terrorists, although I know why people argue that America can be terrorists too, but that's not the point here. I think there's a fair analysis of weapons manufacturers.
It's always like many years later when people talk about the Second World War, but there was a lot of companies or even countries that were double dipping. Look at Switzerland, and everybody just kind of let it go. And
Switzerland was? I didn't know that.
Yeah, they took their Nazi gold.
The neutral people?
Oh, Switzerland was only neutral as far as they wouldn't let their military get involved, but they were sure okay with their banks getting involved.
What? Switzerland.
Ah, they have a lot of wealth that was more or less taken from the Jews during the Holocaust, and then people came to get their money back, and they were like, do you have a death certificate? There was this whole thing that they were helping launder the Nazi money. I could be wrong, but I'm pretty sure that Switzerland got pretty rich during the war they were so neutral on, because they could take from both sides. And I'm plenty sure that there are lots of companies that would have no compunction about getting rich off of all kinds of terrible shit happening in the world. That's certainly true
now. Yeah, Boeing's hands are very dirty. All right, speaking of dirty, this isn't really a dirty moment, but I will make it one. When Pepper puts her hands inside of Tony's chest, that's a sexual role reversal right there. Now, she is helping. I mean, she is saving his life. Like you say, he shouldn't be so close to death so fast, but for the sake of the character, okay, we'll go with it. And it is very interesting that it's the woman doing it to a man, where she's going inside of him.
So she's like the classic reactress. Tony has to be cool all the time. He can't break a sweat. He's got to react to all these extreme situations with his clever quips, what have you. And she's there to look worried and remind the audience that we all care if Tony lives or dies. And that scene is definitely the absolute biggest example of that, that she's so worried about everything and he's so cool, but we have to be reminded that he's fragile, and we have to have a little vulnerable moment for the audience to be reminded that they have chemistry. But I don't think she's really that well cast. I don't really care if these two get together.
And that still is playing out now, the will they, won't they.
Yeah.
I think they've willed at this point in the series, but it's not blatantly obvious, and they're not married or anything at this point. Avengers Infinity War is a scene when we first meet them at the beginning of the film, where they're talking about their future, but they're still not officially together as far as I understand
it. So weird. They have a chemistry in the way that those two actors would have chemistry with literally anyone. They're just those kinds of actors, but I don't buy them together. Pepper never really sees Tony behave with real vulnerability. Even when she's replacing his chest battery, he never loses his cool. And they have this real Smithers-Mr. Burns relationship with each other. Their power dynamic is so unbalanced.
She's more like a doctor.
It's weird that Pepper has no life outside of managing Tony's life.
I think
she is his employee.
Probably the way it happens when you work for somebody as rich as he is. Hollywood star, industrialist. If you work for somebody this rich and this famous and this busy, I could see somebody making probably really good money, but also working nonstop.
Sure, but maybe not also starting a romantic relationship with them. I just don't really root for those two as a couple. Plus, as I said, I have a huge crush on Robert Downey Jr. in this movie, especially when he's in the cave. There is nothing hotter than him, dirty, he's got like a beard, and he's wearing those fingerless gloves.
And he's smelting, or whatever you call it. Smelting. Bang, 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 the iron.
Oh my god, my ovaries went into overdrive.
And he's not making a missile. Well, let's let slide. He's going to get to that eventually. The better love story might be, well, him and Rhodey, we haven't even mentioned him yet, but also the little robot assistant, which was in a lot of the trailers, and it's one of the best things in the whole film, the comic relief as Tony's developing the Iron Man suit, including one, the little guy blasts him with carbon dioxide, I guess, when he's not even on fire. There's a lot of fun stuff with the two of them. The great scene, so cool, when Tony first flies out of his garage and soars over Malibu. I saw this movie in the theater. I liked it a lot. Didn't love it. I bought the Blu-ray. I think it was a pretty good price. I also just bought everything back then, it seemed. Watched it with a few drinks on a Friday night by myself, and I went from being a fan of it to loving it. And one of the reasons why I remember this distinctly was when he soars out of there and the music plays, I thought, yeah, I'm with you. It was a Rocky moment. My arms, I think, were literally in the air when he does that.
We got to pay some compliments to the script. It's quite tight. They don't really waste a lot of scenes. That's one of those things that could just be a montage, but you know what? It comes back in the end when he's fighting with Obadiah and they're flying way up high, and he says, how'd you solve that ice problem? Because he experiences that problem when he's practicing, because he has a solution. He knows he can beat Obadiah that way. Obadiah never tested out the suit. He just put it on and went to town on it. That's part of what makes it such a great, rewatchable movie.
Although, through all of that, Tony's body would be so bashed, pretty much to death, just landing abruptly the way he does. When he lands in, we'll call it Afghanistan, that alone would ruin his body, probably. Never mind all the fighting. But again, sci-fi, based on a comic, you could argue he's somehow cocooned in there. I don't know how.
Every time something like that would happen, we'd be like, dead. Dead. Mm-hmm. Oh, he's dead. There's one point he's falling from the sky at full speed, and he gets hit by a plane while he's falling. He hits the wing of the plane, and he's just like, oh, no.
His brain would be mushed.
You would be in smithereens.
Even if the suit was fine and he was relatively fine inside of it,
he would be liquefied.
His brain itself would be messed up.
Yeah, there's no recovering from something like that. It's ridiculous.
And in that scene, of course, Terrence Howard gets to shine as Rhodey. He'd been great in Hustle and Flow a few years before this. He's been on Empire on TV ever since. Replaced by Don Cheadle, and is the reason why is Big Mouth or racism? Although they replaced a black guy with a black guy, so maybe it wasn't racism so much. Terrence Howard seems like a bit of a handful to work with.
He's had some personal problems as well. I think there's some domestic abuse charges that happened in between then, and maybe that was why Marvel just decided to wash their hands of him, especially if, as you say, he was a handful.
I read somewhere he made more money than Downey did because Downey was not wanted by the studio. So when Favreau had to fight for him, he's not going to get a lot of money. It's like Brando and The Godfather. Coppola wanted him, so you're not going to give the guy a lot of money. And then Brando didn't want to do Godfather Part 2 for that reason alone. He said, well, I'm not going to be in the sequel if you're going to screw me over like this. And Howard wanted to be in Iron Man 2 and 3 and so on. But I guess Cheadle would be easier to deal with. And also, Howard was being paid more, and I guess he wanted even more than he already had been paid.
Robert Downey Jr. now makes more than anybody in the Marvel films.
He probably should.
Because he was the one absolutely indispensable actor that got cast in that first movie that probably didn't have a multi-film contract. They really didn't know if they were going
to
make multiple
films. They lock
films.
Them down now to that kind of thing.
Yeah, right? So now, no matter who you are, you're Scarlett Johansson or you're Jeremy Renner or you're Chris Hemsworth, they've got you locked in at a price. It makes a star out of you, but you are a bit of a slave to Marvel.
For many movies, too. Downey's done 9 Marvel flicks. And let's not forget he's been great in Sherlock Holmes. Well, maybe the movies aren't that great, but he's pretty good as the different version they've done of Sherlock Holmes. And Tropic Thunder, of course, steals that whole movie. But the wealth of great roles before the Marvel movies. So what a career this guy's had. If he died tomorrow, Hall of Fame caliber actor. And movie star, really. Who thought he'd be a movie star? He'd been a good actor for a long time, but that's different. Tom Cruise and even Hugh Jackman by that point, movie stars. Downey was not. Now he is.
And his generation, I don't think there's a better comeback story. I don't know if there's a better comeback story in any generation. The man was written off. Everybody assumed he was going to be dead in a decade. I'll say it again, he actually went to prison for like a year and a half.
His substance abuse issues are serious.
And
even now,
substance
they'll always
abuse,
be with him.
Substance abuse doesn't send you to prison for that kind of time. I think he got into trouble. I can't even remember what he was in prison for. When he finally cleaned up his act, he really cleaned up his act. Who knows what his final act as a person will be? It remains to be seen that he'll stay clean or whatever is keeping him on the straight and narrow now. He seems to have it figured out, but you never know with people like this. But it is a truly incredible story of turning your life around. It would be like Lindsay Lohan turning her life around now.
Maybe she still will.
Maybe she still will.
She's a talented woman in her own right.
So charming. She's got his kind of charisma. And I think I hoped for a long time that she would find her way. But man, you want to talk about stories. I don't think any insurance company will touch her.
So Iron Man does come down to a punch-off and a beam of light in the sky, which wasn't cliche then, but it's become cliche with the MCU ever since. What'd you think of the ending where the two of them fight it out? The little Iron Man versus the great big Ironmonger. Oh, Jeff Bridges, the dude who does not abide cocky little jerks.
I think I enjoyed it. I don't find it quite as boring as some of the punch-offs in other Marvel films. Certainly not when it first came out because it wasn't a cliche, like an overused way to end a film. And I don't feel like it went on and on that long.
True. The arc reactor was also a part of the story the whole time and then is used to defeat the Ironmonger. So it's actually paying off something that was necessary to the plot. Something that had been powering their building for years before.
And maybe it's just a matter of them earning it. The script is so good. The movie, just as an act of storytelling, is so well done that maybe it's just that it's a more earned punch-off than other films have.
Is it ego that makes Tony admit he's Iron Man at the very end of the film? MCU heroes tend to hide in plain sight. We know who they are. Steve Rogers, Tony Stark. Even Bruce Banner, I think, is supposed to have been unveiled in the new versions anyway. Or if he's not, it doesn't really matter. The main guys are. Thor is a god from another world, but we know who he is. Versus the DCEU characters, who are hidden, and we don't know who they are. We're not supposed to. Although Batman's always outed in every movie, but anyway, he's not supposed to be.
Spider-Man, too.
So is it ego that has Tony say? That was the trivia question.
I think the short answer
is... I am Iron Man.
Yes, obviously. I don't think the movie is being cagey about that.
Okay, fair enough. And this movie began Marvel's now obligatory post-credits sequence. I don't think any movie doesn't have a post-credits sequence now. Some of them have multiples, that's why I say sequences. Some of them have at least two. I don't think they ever have three, but anyway... And that's where we see Samuel L. Jackson. I didn't see this scene the first time I saw the movie because I walked out not knowing it was going to be in there. The credits were rolling. I'm going home, or I had to pee, or both. But Sam Jackson comes in with his Avengers Initiative thing, which meant nothing to me anyway. When I would have heard that, I would have thought, I don't know what that means, because to my right is the comic book person, apparently. More than I am, anyway.
Just at this time, I knew certainly more than I know now. And the artist who drew... the Avengers comics drew Nick Fury, the character, to look precisely like Samuel L. Jackson, like he was doing his own little dream casting. So when Sam Jackson shows up and the post credits, all those fans like just lost our minds that they managed to cast him and that they were going to go there, that they were going to make an Avengers film. They didn't shoot that scene until after previews, I think.
Okay.
Because the previews were so good and the audiences liked it so much that they were that optimistic that they could keep making films. Because they really didn't. Like, you talk about Feige having a vision. I was reading an interview with him and, oh, what's the other producer's name?
Avi Arad.
Thank you. Avi Arad, I think, is the one who said when it was so successful, we can make more. Because the Hulk didn't do as well.
They came made out the a month two later. Months.
Yeah, yeah.
And Downey plays himself in the end credits, meeting up with Thunderbolt Ross, the William Hurt version of Thunderbolt Ross, to say, we have something going here. And again, I didn't see that either when I saw that one on the big screen. And it still meant nothing to me anyway. I still didn't know who the Avengers were. Marvel likes their veteran stars to be double dealers. Bridges in this film, Robert Redford is one of the bad guys in Civil War. He is the bad guy in Civil War. And Michael Keaton in Spider-Man Homecoming ends up being a double dealer as well. So they like their classic, especially Bridges and Redford, great all-time actors. And it's hard to get these guys. But then again, as I said in one of our recent podcasts, to appear in a Marvel or DCEU movie is not that hard anymore. It's not like this whole great thing. Glenn Close, John C. Reilly are both in Guardians of the Galaxy, which was nowhere near going to be a big hit until it was a big hit. So name an actor, there's a pretty good chance they've been in one of these kinds of movies. But still, Marvel likes to have their formerly great actors, or even still great actors, to be in these villainous roles and double dealing. Leslie Bibb plays a reporter in this movie. God, she was hot. Iron Man 2, she's in that. In Talladega Nights, and she's now Sam Rockwell's lady. She was actually referenced when he won his Oscar, when he was on stage. Paul Bettany, the voice of Jarvis, who's in all the Iron Mans and Avenger movies as Jarvis, and also Vision. Jarvis stands for Just a Rather Very Intelligent System. I think it's also supposed to be the name of the butler that his father had, but anyway, that's what it is in this case. And Bettany's recording session was apparently less time than the running time of this film. It wasn't even 2 hours, is what I was reading.
I'm telling you, voice acting is a good gig if you can get it.
Well, when it goes this well, too. And then Jon Favreau is happy. In the comics, apparently, he marries Pepper. I guess maybe you knew that? Okay. He's probably still best known for his role in Swingers, even though he's been a very successful director. We'll get to his credits about that in a second. But as an actor, maybe still as the money guy. You're so money in Swingers.
I think as an actor, that's probably how people know him. As a director, he's
had an interesting career.
Yeah. Iron Man. Yeah. And also one of my all-time favorite Christmas movies, Elf.
And also The Jungle Book. And he's currently filming The Lion King. So there are his credits, yeah. And there's more than that. But those four alone, Elf, Iron Man, Jungle Book, and Lion King, will probably be a big hit. Have all been very successful.
Who would have seen him in Swingers and thought, oh, in a decade, this guy's going to be one of the biggest players in Hollywood.
As a director, too.
As a director, yeah.
Yeah, maybe as an actor.
He didn't even direct Swingers. Doug Liman directed Swingers.
That's right. He wrote and started it, though. That's why people think of it as his film. Clark Gregg, who died in The Avengers and was brought back to life in S.H.I.E.L.D., the TV series. They liked him so much they gave him more lines in this, and he becomes a running theme along with Nick Fury in the movies that lead up to The Avengers, which was in 2012. They did quite a few movies. Well, they obviously brought in Captain America and Thor. They never gave individual movies to Black Widow or to Hawkeye, but the other guys all got build-up movies, including Hulk, even though people don't really think of The Incredible Hulk as being part of this, but it is.
And we've seen William Hurt. Recast him, so.
Right, and we've seen William Hurt, though. The only one from that movie to have appeared in a future Marvel movie has been in at least Civil War. John Slattery plays Howard Stark, Tony's father, in future Marvel movies, but it was Gerard Sanders who played him in this one. We just talked about Favreau's other credits. They're pretty good. He decided to move Tony from New York to Malibu because there's too many superheroes that are in New York in total, not just in the Marvel universe, but in the DC universe. Or Gotham and Metropolis, but that might as well be New York.
Yeah, they're just ciphers for New York. I agree with that choice. They could spread it out even more. Have a superhero somewhere outside of America.
Well, that'd be nice, yeah. He seems like he belongs on the West Coast anyway, in somewhere like Malibu, that gray house they gave him, which gets destroyed in part 3.
That's something that X-Men does well, is spreads itself at least around the United States. It doesn't feel like it's localized in one particular
place. And into Canada.
Of course, that's where Logan is from. That's Wolverine is Canadian.
There were all kinds of possible directors before Favreau got the job. He was obviously not the first choice and not the most obvious choice either, including Quentin Tarantino. Might have been the wrong choice for it. Maybe it was best to have a guy who wasn't a Spielberg or a James Cameron Vision kind of person, Vision, but get a guy in there who's a shooter who did a very good job with this film. Most directors they've hired for these Marvel movies have not been, well, maybe to a degree, Kenneth Branagh, but not really visionary directors per se. Nothing against them. Good directors, but Not Spielberg, Lucas, Cameron, those kinds of power guys.
I'd say Joss Whedon is also a bit of an auteur of sorts.
Not at that level, though. Maybe now, but he wasn't when they gave him the job.
The rights to Iron Man was getting tossed around between studios from the 90s. He talked about how Tom Cruise could have done it, but also it could have been New Line, Universal, or Fox. I just said Joss Whedon. Joss Whedon was also signed on to maybe direct it at some point, as was Nick Cassavetes. But they were, but then it just would have been throwaway superhero movie. There were tons of in the 90s. I think the fate it was saved from because probably no studio thought that Iron Man as a character had enough clout or popularity to bother investing in a film. It was just lucky for the character of Iron Man that Marvel decided to run with it and to use that as its first big tentpole film.
The writers were Hawk Ostby, Mark Fergus, Art Markham, and Matt Holloway. The producers, one of them, where we mentioned Avi Arad and Kevin Feige, and nine other people. Arad had done a lot of Marvel movies, including, I believe, the original three Spider-Man, meaning the Sam Raimi, Tobey Maguire ones. The movie is 239-1. We watched the snazzy Blu-ray, which I enjoyed so much many years ago on a Friday with a beverage, and I enjoyed whenever we watched it this time with a beverage, I'm sure. The cinematographer, Matthew Libatique, Matty Libatique, as Darren Aronofsky always calls him. He is an Aronofsky guy. He shot Iron Man 2, though, with Favreau, and he's shooting Venom, which comes out, or he shot it, I guess. It comes out later this year. That'll be with Tom Hardy. The editor, Dan Lebenthal, who's a Favreau guy, most or even all of his movies, also cut Ant-Man and Spider-Man Homecoming. The composer, Raman, or I guess it's pronounced Raman. I don't know how to pronounce his last name. Djawadi. D-J-A-Wadi, who's done music for TV shows Game of Thrones and Westworld. And recently, the finale of Westworld, the reviewer on Entertainment Weekly raved about the music of that show. And then Stan Winston, behind the scenes as the visual effects guy, this is one of his final films. What did you think of all those technical credits on this movie?
Well, I'll start with the score, because you always ask me about the score. I hate this score. I think it's so generic rock music. I use canned music at work all the time. The Iron Man score sounds to me just like when I open up my stock music provider and I type the word rock into the search engine and it would give me this generic rock music.
With the exception at the end of...
I spent the whole movie waiting for them to finally use the song Iron Man instead of the lame rock facsimile, but they save it basically for the credit roll. They should have used it when he emerges from the cave in his homemade suit, or
in the trailer, it's when he lands and he attacks everybody in Afghanistan, saves the civilians, but attacks everybody. He fires off his missiles, turns, and does that cool walk away. I'm pretty sure that's when Iron Man plays in the trailer.
But Favreau wanted the heavy metal soundtrack because he said he saw Stark as more of a rock star than a traditional superhero.
And he is.
And Tom Morello played on it. Tom Morello from Rage Against the Machine, one of the musicians that worked on it. And as for the rest of the technicals, I thought they were excellent. In particular, I think special effects for 2008, they didn't overdo it. They didn't get too ambitious. There's actually probably a fair amount of technical effects compared to Marvel films now. Mm. It's pretty heavy on the technicals. And I think that they found a great solution to the problem of masks, because everybody complained about this with Spider-Man for the whole last act of the film. His face is covered, him and the villain.
No, in Spider-Man movies, his mask always comes off for that reason.
Because in the first Spider-Man movie, the whole last act, his masked face and the Green Goblin, eventually, but I'm saying everybody complained about this. Watch it again, you'll see. There's like a good 10-20 minute spell when they're arguing with each other and with their masks on.
That's the character, though.
Okay, but it was a problem and everybody hated it. So how does Iron Man solve this problem? Well, they had that inside his helmet view, where you could see the figures, kind of like something was projected onto his helmet.
Terminator view. Read.
Yes, Terminator view, yeah, kind
where Jarvis
of. But you could see his face.
Jarvis view.
Mm-hmm. And that's how they got around the mask problem. I thought it was a really good solution.
Well, the movie was nominated for two Oscars, visual effects and sound effects. I call those the Jim Cameron Awards because his movies have often not only been nominated for, but won. Those two, Aliens and Titanic and Terminator 2, of course, have won visual effects and sound effects. As far as influence goes, not a ton for a 10-year-old movie, but it did set the template for future Marvel movies, and it was released about a month before the Hulk, so it beat it to the punch, which is probably for the best, because if Hulk was first, it maybe wouldn't have mattered. People would have loved this movie anyway, but when it didn't have the Hulk, and I like The Incredible Hulk. I don't really like the 2003 one like I did when I first saw it. But the one with Edward Norton I thought was pretty solid, but this was definitely better. And it set a better standard and then moved on to the other ones, Captain America, Thor, and so on.
You don't think that this is an influential film necessarily?
Not hugely 10 years later, but it's influential on the Marvel Universe for one.
And the Marvel Universe is like the biggest film franchise right now. Okay. Hollywood kind of revolves around the Marvel Universe right now. And the whole tone was 100% set by Iron Man. And they've remained pretty consistent. They have yet to have a bomb. They've had movies that haven't been as successful as others, but they've never had a terrible film. And I think Iron Man, with its sense of humor and its lightness, it really did set the template for all the Marvel films, is so influential.
Well, that's huge, but I'm just saying it's not culture necessarily, the way that Dark Knight really permeated culture, that kind of thing.
Well, look what I said earlier, hang out Halloween here, you'll see like every second little boy's dressed up like Iron Man.
Okay. I'm not dismissing the influence, I'm just saying it's not enormous. Okay, maybe it's more than I thought it was, but okay.
Yeah.
Having any kind of influence on culture for 10 years is pretty good, beyond its own universe. All right, well, then last thoughts on Iron Man.
Well, 10 years later, I think it's still a really excellent, fun film, and I'm happy to say that it is aging very well.
RDJ was perfect casting. I was wrong, like a lot of people, when we first heard about the casting. And the movie's flashy and zips along. Great night at the movies. I guess part of the influence thing for me is that the next week's movie is influential in so many ways, and people always refer to it as the pinnacle of its studio success. This one is part of so many good movies that I don't think it's given as much credit as it maybe should be. So maybe that's why I dismissed the influence the way you think I did. So when the next 113 project hits the airwaves on July 16th, we'll be reviewing the best thing the DCEU has ever done, The Dark Knight. This was going to be Superhero Month in total, but we thought two superhero movies was enough, both from 10 years ago, Iron Man and The Dark Knight. And then Who Framed Roger Rabbit 2 weeks ago? Cartoon superhero.
Sure.
So the coming attractions for Via 4, one of the most famous movies that's been made in a long time, The Dark Knight. The Joker character is in, I count, 4 live-action big-screen movies. How many times has the character died in those movies?
So for the answer to that question, check out our next podcast about The Dark Knight. But if you just can't wait and you crave more Ryan and Bev between now and then, check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts. We've covered well over 250 movies now, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode is available for free, but perhaps in exchange for all of that great content, you can give us a rating or a review. We really appreciate it. If you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we're both on Twitter. I am at BevEllisEllis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And once more, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee. Don't forget that you can enjoy a one-time 10% discount on any coffee purchase if you use the code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. That's all one word, TOP100PROJECT, and it's not case-sensitive. Will that be all, Mr. Ellis?
That will be all, Mrs. Ellis.
And cut.
I can't do that at all, can I?